There's nothing the country cured with a wink and a fart, and you're listening to WGXC in Accra, 90.7 FM.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Accra, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. And today on the WGXC Morning Show, we will hear the WGXC Congressional Report with all the latest news of what the representatives of the New York 18, 19, 20, and 21st Congressional Districts have been up to. Plus, we're going to hear the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate, and it all starts after Jason Martin has finished singing this song on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
This is the news. This is the network. Network. On air, in air, waves controlled. On air, in air, channel connection. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network.
This is the news.
This is the network.
This is the news.
This is the network. Network. This is the news.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant.
This is Tom Rowe. You can go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about anything you hear here. Roger Hennigan-Gilson reports for the Times Union that Metro North riders may be paying more to travel through the Hudson Valley next summer after the board of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority increases fares. The board previously looked at raising the cost of commuting by 4% in 2023 and by 4% in 2025. But during its November meeting, the board considered raising fees by 5.5% both years, with the first hike taking effect next June. How the increase will impact individual ticket prices on Metro North has yet to be determined, according to MTA spokesperson Michael Cortez. The MTA board will vote on the hikes as part of the 2023 spending plan on December 21st. The proposed fare hike is part of a larger plan the MTA has to fill the giant budget deficit the authority has experienced as a result of low ridership since the pandemic began in 2020. Ridership is still only 63% of pre-pandemic levels and is expected to rise to 69% in 2023, according to MTA Chief Financial Officer Kevin Willens. This was the primary reason the MTA was projected to suffer a $1.9 billion deficit this year. The proposed fare increases would at first generate an additional $50 million a year and an additional $100 million a year after the 2025 hike. Public hearings will be held before the proposed increases take effect, according to Cortez. Read more about this story in the Times Union.
Andrea Mako reports for Porcupine Zoo that Catskill school officials will hold a public hearing December 14 to get support to spend money from the Repair Reserve Fund after a water main break earlier this month has closed the middle school for more than a week. Officials want to spend public funds on, and I quote, emergency repairs to the middle school heating, electrical, plumbing, mechanical, and alarm systems, end quote, after, and I quote, significant flood damage, end quote, to a boiler room at the West Main Street campus. School officials have not said how much repairs will cost taxpayers. Catskill Middle School students are currently attending classes at the high school because of the water main issues. The public hearing begins at 6:15 p.m. on December 14th in the Catskill High School library, just before a regular Board of Education meeting at 6:30 p.m. Read the full story at Porcupine Soup.
Kevin Tampone for the NewYorkUpstate.com is reporting that two airports located upstate are among the 30 airports in the U.S. with the most delays, according to a recent list from Stacker. Albany International Airport ranked number 29 for delays, and Buffalo Niagara International Airport ranked number 27. The list includes a total of 100 airports. Stacker created the list using data from the U.S. Bureau of Transportation Statistics. Airports were ranked by on-time performance, referring to flights that were not canceled, diverted, or delayed for 15 minutes or more from August 2021 to July 2022. Albany International Airport reported 11,261 flights in 1 year, with 72.47% of those flights arriving on time. The top reasons for delays at the Albany hub: air carriers were 11.6%, aircraft arriving late was 7.7%, canceled flights were 3.2%. Airports in Syracuse and Rochester performed better, ranking in the 50s on the list of 100. The worst performing airport on the list was Punta Gorda Airport in Florida. Just over half of its flights were on time, according to Stacker. The worst New York airport on the list was Long Island MacArthur Airport, with just 69.4% of its flights on time. It ranked as the 14th worst in the nation. Read more about the story at NewYorkUpstate.com.
Kate Lisa reports at New York State of Politics that the end of the year is the time special interest worry that the governor won't sign the bill they got through the legislature earlier in the year. Nurses, for instance, are not worrying about how Governor Kathy Hochul has yet to sign three bills regulating their industry. The bills that would limit the number of consecutive hours New York nurses can work, impose a fine for employers who violate the mandatory overtime restrictions, and expand rules to exclude home care nurses. Currently, healthcare workers work 12-hour shifts, but can be made to work an additional overtime shift. Pat Kane, the executive director of the New York State Nurses Association, said, and I quote, "It's very hard to think that for over a year now you'll show up for work and not know when you're going to be able to go home," end quote. Membership in the nurses' union has dropped 9% since the COVID-19 pandemic began. The healthcare industry does not want more money going to nurses and does not want Hochul to sign the bill. Karen Lipson, executive vice president of Leading Age New York, said, and I quote, "They're going to be forced by this legislation to either mandate overtime and incur penalties or abandon the patients, which they won't do. So the penalties will be inevitable," end quote. Hochul won't say what she will do before the New Year's. Justin Mason, a governor spokesperson, said, and I quote, "We are reviewing this legislation, and the governor looks forward to working with the legislature during the upcoming session," end quote. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics.
Raymond Pignone reports for Columbia Green Media that the Alana Partnership on December 13th will formally announce the details of how it intends to use $25 million raised for capital projects at the Alana State Historic Site. New York State Parks Commissioner Eric Kulseid will make the announcement and will be joined by state and local officials, as well as representatives of the Alana Partnership and the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. Some grants were obtained by the Alana Partnership and will come in conjunction with state funding. The $25 million in public and private funds will be used for significant capital projects at Alana, including the Frederick Church Center, a new visitor entry and culture orientation facility, and the cornerstone of the Alana Partnership's future capital development plan for the 250-acre site. December 2021, Assemblymember Dee Dee Barrett announced $1 million in state funding she helped obtain to assist with the construction of the Frederick Church Center for Art and Landscape. The $1 million award is the largest single grant from the Assembly to a New York State historic site. The Alana Partnership also received in late 2021 a $1.8 million grant and a second $1.4 million that will be used for the Frederick Church Center capital project. Quote, "The Frederick Church Visitor Center will not only be a tribute to his legacy, but it will serve as a landing place for more than 170,000 locals and visitors," unquote, Barrett said in 2021. "The center will inform visitors about the church family and Olana and help visitors understand the story of one of America's greatest 19th century artists." Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com.
Skylar Eagle reports for News 10 that as National Grid officials said they expect some heating prices to increase by 39% for natural gas and 22% for electric this winter, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was in Albany City Hall December 12th to tout aid available to help with those higher bills. She said anyone in need should turn to the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program. Gillibrand said, and I quote, "It provides money for families when they have nowhere left to turn. It offers them support to keep their homes heated and keep themselves safe," end quote. Now there's $412 million for New Yorkers that need utility bill assistance after Congress added $63 million more to the program in September because of rising inflation. Gillibrand said New Yorkers should not face the cold winter because of the higher prices. Gillibrand said, and I quote, "Some people can simply not afford that, especially after these last few years with COVID, where many people have been struggling to make ends meet. Going without utilities is not an option," end quote. Read the full story at News 10.
And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day.
And now, here is your WGXC weather update. Your forecast for the next 2 days. Well, on Tuesday, it will be sunny with a high near 35 degrees. Tuesday night, mostly clear with a temperature low of around 18 degrees. And on Wednesday, sunny with a high near 33 degrees. And Wednesday night, partly cloudy with a temperature low of around 18 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC. 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, in Greene and Columbia Counties.
Tuesday, December 13th, tune in to all sorts of creative community voices on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM, including at 9 a.m. tune in for the WGXC Congressional Report, tracking all the latest news from the 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional districts in New York. Then at 11 a.m., it's time for the Early Electro Mix Show with tracks from Ann Southam, Reinhard Bird, and David Yeager, among others this week. At noon, after the local news, it's time for Rob Saffer's Overlook Show, live from Ulster County this week with brand new music from this year from Dry Cleaning, Enrico Rava and Fred Hirsch, Dan Weiss, Jeremy Rose, Black Math Horseman, and others. Heidi Nielsen, Annie Gosfield, and Steve Roden are the featured artists on the Radio Art Hour at 3 p.m. And then tune in for all the latest movie news and more at 7 p.m. with Dim the Lights with Jenny and Amanda. Then it's time for an evening of music, first at 8 p.m. with Andy French's Crawl Out from the Fallout, and at 10 p.m. with Dan Seward's Battlefield Earth program on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Get a local event mentioned on All Together Now. Go to WGXC.org and click on Add an Event at the top of the page. And copy and paste the information about your event in the boxes. Let's all get involved in our community. See what's going on at WGXC.org in the community calendar.
There is a Kwanzaa celebration put on by Operation Unite on December 17th at the Hudson Opera House, 5 p.m. It's an afternoon of arts and crafts for children. There's also dancing, drumming, a candle lighting ceremony, the sharing of the Nguza Saba, the seven principles of Kwanzaa, and more as Operation Unite puts on a Kwanzaa celebration Saturday, December 17th at 5 p.m. at the Hudson Opera House on Warren Street in Hudson. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org.
Thank you.
the Public News Service Daily Newscast for December the 13th, 2022. I'm Mike Clifford. Auto safety consumer groups are blasting a recent settlement between 36 states and CarMax, which fined the company $1 million for claiming its cars are safe when some of them are under manufacturer safety recalls and have not been repaired.
California did not sign on to the agreement and has laws that allow consumers to sue in such cases. Rosemary Shahan is president of the group Consumers for Auto Reliability and Safety, based in Sacramento.
It's going to make it easier for CarMax to get away with claiming that their vehicles have passed a 125-point inspection without repairing deadly safety recall defects, as long as they don't use the word safe or repaired for safety.
CarMax said in a statement that the company is not authorized by manufacturers to repair recall defects. It claims it discloses all recalls to customers. I'm Suzanne Potter.
CarMax reported revenues of $33 billion in the fiscal year ending August 31. Conservation and hunting groups are concerned about Governor Greg Gianforte's decision in his proposed budget not to distribute revenue from recreational cannabis for the Habitat Montana program. Eric Tadoff explains.
The 2020 initiative legalizing cannabis for recreational use set aside tax revenue for conservation on state public lands through programs such as Habitat Montana. The program has been around since 1987. Mike Penfold is a retired employee of the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management. He says he's disappointed the governor has not included tax revenue from cannabis for Habitat Montana in his budget.
Habitat Montana has been really effective at conservation easements that protect wildlife habitat and sometimes provide public access on private land, but also allow the private land activities to continue.
Gianforte's proposal includes $12 million for Habitat Montana, which is an increase from the last budget cycle, but eliminates about $30 million in projected cannabis tax revenue. A spokesperson for the governor says Gianforte continues to focus on the state's public lands, but wants the cannabis revenue to be used to serve veterans, strengthen treatment services, and boost law enforcement.
About half of the revenue generated from cannabis sales was designed to be set aside for conservation on public lands, according to the voter-approved initiative. Now from CBS News, the White House reacting sharply to comments made over the weekend by Marjorie Taylor Greene. The Georgia Republican spoke Saturday at a dinner hosted by the New York Republican Club. "I want to tell you something," she said. "If Steve Bannon and I had organized, we would have won. This is PNS." Many disadvantaged neighborhoods in urban areas are considered food deserts because there are few places where people could find healthy, fresh food. But if you head to an empty lot in East Detroit, there's a group of young farmers of color looking to change that.
John Cannon, a cadre of volunteers, are sustainably growing hearty greens, root vegetables, corn and squash in the central city to feed the surrounding community. Kent, the co-founder of Sanctuary Farms, says his operation is different because it uses growing techniques that don't contribute to water pollution and climate change.
What we do at Sanctuary Farms is cultivate organic produce, create nutritious compost, and through that process, we're closing the food loop by diverting food waste from landfills.
Kent and his business partner, Gene Parker, started the operation in 2020 with an eye toward practicing regenerative agriculture. According to a new report from the National Young Farmers Coalition, many young farmers share Kent's commitment to sustainability. 86% of a poll of 10,000 farmers under the age of 40 say they use sustainable practices. Mark Richardson reporting.
Reporting for this story funded by the Solutions Journalism Network. Now to South Dakota, where in the coming session, lawmakers could be asked to clarify state laws dealing with the counting of election ballots.
Political observers say that push is connected to false claims by conservative groups that the 2020 presidential election was stolen and electronic counting machines were compromised. That led to hand counts in two South Dakota counties in the recent midterm vote. Amy Scott Stoltz of the South Dakota League of Women Voters says this broader approach is counterproductive.
We just want to make sure that people know that that is a less accurate way to count the votes.
She and the Secretary of State say electronic machines are certified and are not connected to the Internet, protecting them from being compromised. I'm Mike Moen.
Finally, our Edwin J. Vera tells us while Virginia is leading southern states in climate smart programs, it still has a problem with woody biomass.
Woody biomass has come under fire because it's long been viewed as a great renewable resource, but opponents argue it's more akin to coal since it burns carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Governor Glenn Youngkin included woody biomass as a new energy the state will invest in as part of its new energy plan. Laura Height, with the Partnership for Policy Integrity, feels woody biomass has survived this long because it gets misclassified as a renewable energy.
As long as but lawmakers treat burning wood as renewable or carbon neutral, it's going to get the same exact financial incentives as wind and solar. I think people want, when they think of clean energy, they want non-polluting renewable energy.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Hear us on interesting radio stations, your favorite podcast platform. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Tuesday, December 13th. The local early morning temperature range reaches across the border this morning. 7 degrees in Tyringham, Massachusetts, to 19 degrees over here in Voorheesville. Well, not here, but regionally here. Also regionally, the average soil temperature is 36 degrees. 200 miles away in Vermont will be the closest likely snowfall today, with no new local accumulations reported. A sunny sky betrays the freezing conditions present today. Coats, gloves, and hats if going outside. A high of 36 happens at 3 p.m. Refreeze occurs around 5 p.m. Be vigilant for surface ice. Overnight, we drop to 20 degrees. Then, tomorrow, after a windy morning, we get a high of 35 degrees at 2 p.m. 22 degrees overnight takes us into a Thursday with a high of 36 and a snowy afternoon. So far, it looks like the snow turns to rain overnight, and Friday will be rainy all day with a high of 38. Sunset today will be at 4:11 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:11 a.m. I know those were the numbers I gave out yesterday, but things get weird this time of the year because, number one, I'm calculating for the effect of the mountains on our area, and the time really starts to just get weird on its own because of the solstice. The earliest sunset was last Wednesday. The latest sunrise is going to be on January 4th, so things aren't always perfectly balanced, and such is nature. Looking way up, we see Earth is entering a flying pile of garbage left behind by the comet 3200 Phaethon, otherwise known as the annual Geminid meteor shower, due to peak tonight or tomorrow. Solar wind speed is currently 387 kilometers per second at 4.3 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 4 megahertz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 2.6, quiet. The current sunspot number is 142. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Pat of Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by SunCommon, supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
QSL. QSL. Greetings, listeners. We would like to present a special opportunity to collect a series of finely crafted QSL cards that display your affiliation with our friendly neighborhood radio station These 5x7 QSL cards bear our call letters WGXC and important information regarding training, underwriting, youth and adult programming, and our FCC-licensed frequency, 90.7 MHz on the FM dial. Simply send in a postcard stating your name, address, and we will send you the latest in a series of periodically released QSL cards. Send your postcard to our Acre studio at The Wave Farm, 5662 Route 23, Acre, New York, 12405. Thank you for tuning in to WGXC today and every day.
If you like music that's off the beaten path, and often off the beat, then tune in to Overlooked, the second and fourth Tuesday of the month, just after the noon news. You'll hear underplayed and overlooked music of all genres, continents, and omniverses. Overlooked on WGXC 90.7 FM.
And you,
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 and you. are listening.
You're listening to 90.7 WGXC Acre
Catskills.
Today, East Durham.
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 Catskills.
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 Catskills. Catskills.
Unsilent Night is an original composition by Phil Klein, written specifically to be heard outdoors in the month of December. He's been holding them at various cities around the world since 1992. Special composition for boombox radios, where multiple speakers make one shimmering seasonal composition. This year, one of the locations for Unsilent Night is in Kingston, New York. That's on December 16th from 6 to 7 p.m. Go to unsilentnight.com for more information about the specific location that will be announced shortly. Go to the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org for more information about all sorts of local events.
That was Roel Funken with Zenus Alphalon from the 2022 album Hexvalent.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It may not be the same as a physical fight or a physical altercation, but words and images can be painful. And people carry that within them. And that's why we have to let it out. We have to let people know what is happening to this community. Be public about it. Rise up, in a sense.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced the creation of a new hate and bias prevention unit, which would lead public education and outreach efforts and serve as an early detection system in local communities. This comes as anti-Semitism is rising in the state and across the country. According to NYPD crime statistics, hate crimes against Jewish people were up 125% from the same period in 2021. Hochul also approved a measure preventing insurance companies from raising rates on people who have filed claims for being the victim of a hate crime. Congress could be deadlocked on a new budget. Senator Chuck Schumer says passing the short-term continuing resolution would buy lawmakers some time, but warned the Department of Veterans Affairs would be especially hard hit.
Last week, the VA wrote Congress a letter warning that a CR would mean a $10 billion shortfall for the VA. That means fewer health care workers on the job. It would mean a surge in the backlog of claims.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is expected to raise interest rates again. It's part of a strategy to reduce inflation to 2%. Peter Morici, a University of Maryland professor, says inflation is not easy to manage.
There's no longer a sense of a coronation as opposed to a contest. And I think in American politics, regardless of what party you align with, or if you're an independent, you align with independents, that's a good thing.
Republicans are wondering about the future of the party following the midterms. Strategist Adam Goodman finds candidates who are parroting former President Donald Trump's rhetoric aren't cutting it. He says it is refreshing that voters are paying attention to the candidate's character, the issues, and what they want for the country. Goodman described how the 2024 presidential election is shaping up.
We are in a very difficult inflationary situation. It is getting very much embedded in wage negotiations and so forth, and we're not taking this seriously enough. It's going to take a great deal of good luck.
John Ray, CEO of FTX, will testify before a House committee about why the company collapsed. He was named CEO after the company filed for bankruptcy. This comes as FTX's founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, was arrested in the Bahamas after U.S. prosecutors filed an indictment against him. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. With so much midterm drama, we haven't updated you on redistricting issues recently, and the redistricting in 2 states is again in the news. In Kansas, the Republican legislature gerrymandered the 3rd congressional district, which includes heavily black Kansas City, with the intention of diluting black voting power. The Kansas ACLU and the Campaign Legal Center are taking the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. They argue that under the 14th Amendment, gerrymandering the district was intentional race discrimination by reducing the number of minority voters and depriving it of its proper representation. If the High Court takes the case, it will likely be considered in 2023. Ohio has struggled for 2 years to create fair maps, despite a constitutional amendment which forbids redistricting from favoring or disfavoring either political party. The Ohio Supreme Court's Chief Justice and fierce advocate for upholding that constitutional amendment, Maureen O'Connor, steps down at the end of December due to a retirement age mandate. O'Connor, a Republican, was threatened with impeachment by members of her own party, but upheld the Constitution. Her retirement opens the door to a new justice who will be appointed by a governor shown to support gerrymandered maps. New maps must be completed by the 2024 election. The current gerrymandered maps help to lock in a veto-proof majority in the 2022 midterms. Articles and groups taking action can be found at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. For the American Democracy Minute, I'm Brian Beal.
This is the WGXC Congressional Report, tracking the votes, statements, positions, and campaigns of the representatives and candidates for the 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional seats in New York. Current Democratic Representative Paul Tonko from the 20th District votes with the positions of President Joe Biden 100% of the time, according to the 538.com website.
Republican Elise Stefanik, currently representing the 21st District, votes with Biden's positions 19.3% of the time. Democrat Pat Ryan just began representing the 19th Congressional District and has yet to be included in the 538 rankings. Ryan will represent the 18th Congressional District in January, when Republican Mark Molinaro takes over representing the 19th Congressional District.
Kevin Frey in New York State of Politics speaks with Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro, recently elected to represent New York's 19th Congressional District. Republican Molinaro claims the midterm results show Americans want leaders to work together, taking away Democrats' control of the House of Representatives. Molinaro said, and I quote, "It is our responsibility not only to provide the checks and balances and results here in Washington, but I think also to speak up when Albany acts in a way that New Yorkers don't feel is appropriate for them," end quote. New York was key for Republicans flipping the House, with four districts switching from Democrats after the votes were counted. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics.
Mid-Hudson News is reporting that a group of Hudson Valley Democratic Party chairs has written to longtime state chair Jay Jacobs, asking him to implement four common-sense reforms to increase Democratic operations, provide robust support for county committees, expand and diversify the voices involved in decision-making, and strengthen the party's infrastructure ahead of the next election cycle. The general election this month saw mixed results in the Hudson Valley, ranging from successes in Ulster and Westchester counties to, quote, disappointing outcomes, unquote, for statewide candidates in several counties, as well as the loss of state legislative and congressional seats previously held by Democrats. Last week, two letters were circulated, one calling on Jacobs to step down from his party leadership role, and the other from county chairs offering their continued support. The members of the Greater Hudson Valley Coalition declined to sign on to either letter. That group wrote their own letter to Jacobs asking state leadership to convene a session of the State Democratic Committee's Executive Committee before the end of the year to present, discuss, and adopt a plan to implement their reforms. The letter is signed by Columbia County Chair Sam Hodge, Lori Turgeson of Greene County, Michael Dupree and Julie Shiroshi of Dutchess County, and Kaylee McKenzie of Ulster County, and others. Read more about the story at MidHudsonNews.com.
Mid-Hudson News reports that while Pat Ryan currently represents the 19th Congressional District in the House of Representatives, he is about to change to the 18th Congressional District in January. Ryan won a special election in August to fill in the final weeks of Representative Antonio Delgado's term in the 19th District after he left to become Lieutenant Governor. Ryan then was elected for a full term in the new 18th Congressional District in November, which means he switches districts in January. On November 28th, Ryan was more in 18th Congressional District mode, speaking just outside of West Point in support of passage of the National Defense Authorization Act. Quote, "When it comes to our veterans, our military families, we have to rise above this partisan divide we have in our country right now, come together as patriots and make sure that we deliver in keeping our country safe and supporting our troops and our military families," unquote, he said. In particular, Ryan said $39.8 million would go towards the continuing construction of the $200 million West Point Cyber and Engineering Center, and $1.6 million would upgrade barracks and child development centers at West Point if the National Defense Authorization Act was passed in its current state. There's also a 4.6% pay raise for active duty members and civilians in the bill. Read more about this story at MidHudsonNews.com. Steve Bennin reports for MSNBC that Representative Elise Stefanik is keeping up her full-throated defense of former President Donald Trump, but is so far mum on his dinner with a leading figure among white supremacists and anti-Semites. After Attorney General Merrick Garland appointed Jack Smith to oversee the criminal investigation into Trump, the former president ordered his backers to defend him, saying, quote, "You people have to fight. You have to fight. You have to be strong," unquote. So on November 29th, Stefanik told the far-right Breitbart News that, quote, "The facts are clear. Jack Smith is compromised. Joe Biden's weaponized DOJ has launched an illegitimate special counsel to investigate his number one political opponent," unquote. She said, "When Republicans take over the House of Representatives in January, they will launch a counter-investigation," although she did not say exactly what they would investigate. Meanwhile, Stefanik is quiet so far on Trump's dinner meeting with notorious anti-Semites Kanye West and Nick Fuentes. PBS NewsHour asked 57 Republican lawmakers for comment on that meeting. And Stefanik is one of the many not responding with any comment about the former president meeting with fringe political figures with hateful political views. Stefanik represents the 21st Congressional District in New York that includes Rensselaer County. Read more about this story at the MSNBC website.
Carl Campanelli is reporting for the New York Post that Republican Representative Elise Stefanik is accusing U.S. Postal Service workers of opening her campaign mail and stealing $20,000 in campaign checks. Stefanik, the House GOP conference chair, made the claim in a December 1st letter to Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. Quote, "We are writing you on behalf of our clients, Congresswoman Elise Stefanik and her campaign committee, Elise for Congress, concerning the repeated targeted theft of campaign contributions from packages sent through the United States Postal Service," unquote, wrote attorney Michael Toner. Toner alleged that on four occasions between June and November this year, packages sent by the Elise for Congress committee containing campaign contributions were ripped open and the contents taken on the custody of the post office or its contractors. The attorney further alleged that in addition to the loss of campaign contributions, hundreds of Stefanik supporters were exposed to potential identity theft or financial fraud. It is unclear if any of the stolen checks were cashed. The U.S. Postal Service or of the Inspector General is investigating the mail theft, but Toner and said the IG's office, quote, "which recovered the discarded ripped open packages in Memphis, has not returned our clients' calls," unquote. Stefanik is demanding the Postal Service provide her with a full update by December 8th on what has been done to date in investigating the thefts and what measures it will take to prevent or prosecute mail theft against her and other Americans in the future. Postal Service spokesperson Dave Partenheimer said, quote, "We did receive a letter on December 1st from representatives of Elise for Congress, and we will respond to the sender directly with our findings on this investigative matter. In matters like this, both the Postal Inspection Service and Office of Inspector General have a potential role to play," unquote. Read more about this story in the New York Post.
Kenneth C. Crow II reports in the Times Union that the floating solar array for Coho City Reservoir is not in the water yet, but Representative Paul Tonko wants to create similar projects across the nation. Tonko is introducing legislation for federal support to replicate the project. Tonko, a Democrat representing the 20th Congressional District, said on December 2nd, and I quote, "The innovative project in Cohoes shined a light on the advantages of floating solar to reach our nation's renewable energy goals and reduce bills for families and communities. Since the inception of this project, I've said that Cohoes Reservoir will serve as a model for the nation, and with my Power Our Reservoirs Act that I just introduced, it will do just that," end quote. Cohoes Mayor Bill Keeler predicts that the $5.9 million array with 8,000 solar panels will be floating in the fall of 2024 or the spring of 2025. Keeler said, and I quote, "We said from the start this could be a national model. We've been working with the congressman. He's been super enthusiastic and a great help to us financially," end quote. Tonko says a 2018 study by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory found that deploying floating solar on the county's more than 24,000 human-made reservoirs could save 2.1 million hectares of land and meet 10% of the country's electricity needs. Solar arrays in water cost more than land-based systems, but have other benefits, including reducing algal blooms. Read the full story in the Times Union.
This has been the WGXC Congressional Report, tracking the votes, statements, positions, and campaigns of the representatives and candidates for the 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional seats in New York. Go to WGXC.org for more information.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're joined by Bob Cohen, one of the staff people for Citizen Action, has been quite active with the development of the state climate law, CLCPA, and now its draft plan. Bob, I understand that a number of groups have come together to raise concerns about the process as we move towards, I believe, a December 19th vote on the draft plan. What are some of the concerns?
Sure, Mark. Thanks for having me. I think our concerns
fall under, I would say, three things, basically. One is there are ongoing concerns that have been raised all along by community groups, climate justice groups, et cetera, about things like hydrogen, things like renewable gas that are untested and there are better solutions. Secondly, which I hesitate to say, but I guess I would have to say nefariously, they have put in last-minute changes to the plan, as far as we can tell, that even move us backwards. And the third thing is just public participation. We had this rather elaborate process of hearings, public attending meetings, thousands and thousands of comments. And yet we will not apparently see the scoping plan unless they reverse themselves. That's the topic of our letter or that we sent out on Monday. We will not see what the Climate Action Council members are voting on, which is contrary to the law and contrary to the basic notions of public participation.
Yeah, I was at the December 5th meeting, and one of the local climate activists came up and raised that question to me. And I did look at the open meetings law, which does says if a deliberative body is reviewing documents, that document's supposed to be made available to public at least 72 hours in advance. And I read the CLCPA law. I saw nothing that exempted this council from the open meetings law. You know, why has the state, you know, three and a half years after the CLCPA law, been so unwilling to share, you know, what basically is a blueprint for how they're going to try to save life on the planet?
Yeah. So just one minor qualification. The law says 24 hours, not 72 hours. But anyway, it's still, your general point still holds. I find it difficult to figure out what their motivations are or anybody's motivations. I will, you know, sort of speculate that they're very concerned about the press scrutiny about this and scrutiny by groups like mine and many others. And it's a little, you know, from their perspective, it's a little easier to control the narrative, as they say, by just having a vote and having people not then have to scramble to read the plan a few days later. But again, that's really just speculation on my part.
I'll mention is that policy wonks like you and myself are very interested in the details. But when the first process went through, the issue that a lot of people focused upon was the issue of whether or not they were going to ban wood stoves, which, you know, is an issue to debate, but is not exactly the most critical part of the climate plan. But how is the legislature going to react, you know, to this? They've been sort of sitting there not doing much for the last 3 years, waiting for this plan. And now this plan is going to come out largely written, I would contend, by the governor's staff, often behind closed doors, as you point out. You know, will the legislature be willing to make its own independent determination on some of these, you know, key issues like the role of hydrogen and how much money we're actually going to give to environmental justice communities and how we're going to pay for this thing? You know, whether it's going to be a carbon tax or a tax on the wealthy or something they're now calling cap and invest, which seems to be largely the old cap and trade program that we already have with Reggie, which has sort of mixed reviews.
Well, obviously, the standard response, Mark, about the legislatures, it remains to be seen. But I can say that there are some encouraging signs. There has been at least rumors that the Senate will be holding hearings on the scoping plan. I don't think that has been absolutely decided. I certainly hope they do that. Because I think they need to carefully look at this. Also, there's a number of pieces of legislation last session that at least got moved, in some cases passed. The cryptocurrency moratorium was signed happily by the governor a couple of weeks ago. It took a while, but she did that. So I think the legislature has shown a willingness in the past on a few limited topics to get involved. And I think the inadequacy of the scoping plan will hopefully light a fire under them that they have to become much more involved than they have since 2019 when the CLCPA, the climate law, passed.
Now, one thing I'll just quickly note for our listeners is that the two key people in the legislature, the chair of the Senate and the Assembly Environmental Conservation Committee, which handles climate, are not returning next year. And so, in fact, new leadership will have to be selected. But one of the big issues, and in fact, in many ways, the one issue which the Climate Council last year spoke out on was the need to end the use of gas in new buildings and go to the All Electric Buildings Act. And now the council appears to be pushing that back a year while also arguing that's not really all that important since, you know, we build 50,000 new buildings a year where there's, I don't know, 5 or 6 million existing buildings. How are people feeling about this, you know, at least some retreat on the one issue which the Climate Council had spoken out last year?
Well, I think it's safe to say that many organizations, including mine, are really concerned about that delay. It does seem to be driven by a combination of real estate industry concerns, maybe some union concerns. It's a little bit unclear. I think the union movement is sort of split on this, from what I could tell, or at least ambivalent. And, you know, I think really what it comes down to as a broad picture is that we, those of us who advocated for the climate law to pass in 2019, envisioned an open process, and it seems like we've had almost this mirage. We've had all the, you know, the appearance of an open process, and yet, in the last minute, industry has intervened. So it's really disturbing from a public policy standpoint, an open government standpoint, and unfortunately, this is far from the first, and will unfortunately be not the last time this happens in New York State.
So what can, you know, can people, you know, do at this point to, I mean, December 19th is a week away, you know, how do we get the state Climate Action Council to actually, at least in the last month, have transparency? And also, I was a little bit surprised, it does sound like at least the DEC chair kind of acts as if the Climate Action Council disappears on January 1st, once this climate plan is released, that he doesn't see them having a role in terms of its, you know, follow-up implementation, even though there's tons of next steps in terms of the state energy master plan needs to be updated, and both DEC and the Public Service Commission have to develop various rules and proceedings. That was a little bit of a shock. But what can people do in the last minute?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, certainly people should contact DEC, call them, call NYSERDA. But I have to be honest here and say it does seem like the state is on the track to approve it, and they do have a statutory mandate. While I wouldn't say people shouldn't call, quite frankly, the focus of our advocacy is going to have to be in the legislature next year. And also with the agencies, the next major step that must be taken in climate policy in New York State is DEC has to do regulations based on the scoping plan.